Well, I'm going to talk about borderline personality features in childhood, and this will be the first presentation of several that are going to focus on children and adolescents, which I'm very excited about. I think this is the largest number of presentations that focus on youth at any conference that I've been a part of, and so I find that progress very exciting. And I want to mention before I begin with my presentation, because I'm afraid I'll forget if I leave it to the end, that Dante Cicchetti and I are co-editing a special, actually two special issues in the journal Development and Psychopathology on the development of personality disorders in childhood and adolescence. They will come out sometime in 2009, probably mid to late year. I just wanted to alert you if you're interested in looking for those in about a year or so. And the reason we're having two special issues is because we had almost a 95% of the individuals that we asked to contribute articles agreed to do so. And typically, Dante says he has a long history with this journal. He started this journal many years ago. He's done many special issues over the years. And he says his agreement rate is typically about 50%. So he always invites twice as many individuals as he thinks will agree to write a paper. And so I take this as an N of one, but good indication that there's more and more interest among researchers in the development of borderline personality as well as personality disorders more generally speaking. And I also should let you know that a number of the articles have come in. We're expecting about 36, and many of them do either focus on include a discussion of the development of BPD as well, so it'd be a particular interest to this group. All right. I think Sue mentioned when she started us off this morning that this particular area is one that has only in relatively recent years been targeted by academic researchers. Why might that be? Well, for many years, not surprisingly, there's been a held belief that stable personality disorders don't emerge until late adolescence or adulthood. If you look at the diagnosis of BPD and the DSM, it's discouraged until age 18. It's almost as if on your 18th birthday, some individuals wake up and voila, they have a personality disorder. Is that true? I don't think many of us in this room, if any, would agree with that. But there has been a reluctance to use the personality disorder label with children for ethical reasons, not wanting to label them in ways that are going to cause them to have negative consequences because of that label. And one of the implications of this lack of attention to borderline personality prior to the age 18 is that many age-appropriate measures have been lacking. Now, in the area of in the developmental period of adolescence, I think we see a lot more in terms of research than we do in younger children, and so that's been a great start. And you'll hear folks talking about adolescence later today and tomorrow. So does BPD all of a sudden appear on some individual's 18th birthday? Well, it seems likely, highly likely, that there are developmental precursors to the adult diagnosis of borderline pathology, and that these precursors, like the disorder in adulthood, reflect stable patterns of ways and patterns of thinking, of feeling, and of behavior that are significant in their own right. And I want to add a little interlude here, which is that I started my career at the University of Illinois a number of years ago. I came to the University of Minnesota in 1996. I have been trying to get funded by NIH for over a decade to study the development of borderline personality disorder, and I actually haven't achieved that goal yet, not from NIH, but I'm still working on it. I'm trying again this next year with my collaborator Dante Cicchetti, but I think that's reflective of the state of the empirical field in the past number of years. In fact, I was directly told about 15 years ago by my program officer, or as one of my colleagues likes to call them, parole officers at NIH, that if you want to study borderline personality and the development of it in children, bury it somewhere in fine print in your proposal where no one can find it. Or just do it and don't tell us about it. You know, say you're doing something else and then study that. Because if you put that in there, it'll get shot down. You'll never get funded. I hear some people laughing. Similar stories? Yes. That does seem to be changing somewhat. It's been a slow progress. And so I'm hopeful that the future is bright for funding in this area, or as bright as funding in any area can be right now, given the current state of our economy. Why is it important to acknowledge the possibility that there are childhood precursors to borderline pathology? Well, it allows for the identification and study of these early predictors, and it also provides an important opportunity for prevention or intervention efforts when stable patterns start to emerge prior to adulthood. We all know from a great deal of evidence that the earlier we can implement prevention and intervention programs, the more likely we are to be effective. And so if we could identify children or adolescents who are at risk for the development of BPD, it would behoove us to do something about those patterns that are starting to stabilize or starting to congeal before they become completely stable and that individual is on a trajectory toward the development of a full-blown disorder. So this brings us to kind of the million-dollar question, which is, how might developmental processes be reflected in borderline pathology? And in a recent review paper, my co-authors and I identified three different approaches to this question that we saw in the current literature. The first is that risk factors for adult BPD may reflect a failure to negotiate developmentally salient tests during childhood. The second we identified was that risk factors for adult BPD may reflect atypical patterns of personality development in childhood. And the third possibility is that borderline pathology exists in childhood, but it's expressed perhaps in different ways that are more age appropriate given the developmental stage of the child. And I'm going to talk about each of these in turn. So the first is that risk factors for adult BPD may reflect a failure to negotiate tasks that are appropriate developmentally for the child during their particular stage of development. Now, this approach is based on a developmental psychopathology perspective, whereby trajectories of adaptation or developing in a healthy, typical manner reflects the individual's ability to master important or salient developmental tasks. So this perspective proposes that at each stage of development, children are faced with unique challenges. And I give an example here, which is establishing a secure attachment with a caregiver during infancy or forming intimate relationships with peers during adolescence. This perspective proposes that when a problem arises or psychopathology happens, that results from an inability to utilize both internal resources as well as external resources to negotiate these challenges. So from this perspective, borderline personality disorder may result from a failure to achieve these important developmental milestones. If so, how can we identify the developmental challenges that are particularly salient for the development of borderline pathology? Well, my co-author, Tasha Geiger, and I, a few years back, conducted a content analysis of the DSM symptoms for the diagnosis of personality disorders in general, with the goal of identifying themes that we could match to the developmental literature that have shown to be important tasks of childhood and adolescence. And what I'm going to share with you are the five childhood indicators that emerge for borderline personality disorder. And if you're interested in the other themes that emerge, I can give you the full reference for that particular manuscript. But I'm just going to talk about the BPD indicators today. The first is hostile paranoid worldview. This may result from a failure to develop the ability to accurately identify and interpret the behaviors and intentions of others. So having difficulty trying to figure out whether a person is meaning you harm, for example, or whether a person is not meaning you harm. So, for example, say you're standing in line at a water fountain and someone comes up from behind, they're rushing off to a meeting or class, and they bump into you. Well, how do you interpret that kind of action? Do you think the person came up and deliberately ran into you because they were trying to harm you in some way, or maybe make you lose your place in line, or maybe they're just ticked off at you, who knows? That would be a hostile attribution or a paranoid worldview. Hold on. My computer's talking to me here. Or do you assume that the other person's intent was benign? So maybe you figure, they're in a hurry, they're in a rush, they're clumsy, they just accidentally bumped up against me. Well, there have been a number of studies, in fact, I would say hundreds at this point, which have shown that there's a tendency that some children exhibit, which in the literature is called a hostile attributional bias, meaning that the child tends to think that the person is out to get them. It's a paranoid-like type cognition, and it's been shown to be significantly related to adjustment problems, including relational and physical aggression, and also borderline personality features. The second indicator that we identified is intense, unstable, and inappropriate emotion. So the idea here is that the exaggerated emotional reactions to interpersonal situations that are typical of adult borderline may reflect the failure in childhood to develop important emotion regulation skills, which is a salient developmental task of infancy. Let's think about babies for a little bit and how they learn to regulate emotion. How did they do it? Did they come out of the womb able to regulate emotion, to stop crying if they are upset about something? No, absolutely not. Caretakers have to help them with that job at first and soothe them and help them to regulate their own emotion, and then use scaffolding or other similar kinds of techniques so that the child eventually, when they reach a particular age, are able to take over more and more and more of that task themselves. But they need the caretaker there when they're young in order to help them do that. Well, perhaps for whatever reason, whether it's due to temperament, whether it's due to deficits in the attachment relationship or the caretaking parent-child relationship, some children do not learn to effectively regulate their own emotions, and that may be a childhood indicator of the development of borderline pathology. The third indicator we identified we called overly close relationships. This is an interpersonal style, may reflect difficulties with another important developmental task that begins in childhood and continues particularly into adolescence, and that has to do with trying to balance trust and autonomy in relationships. So, you know, there's this conflict particularly in adolescence between wanting to trust the other person, have some dependency upon them in an intimate, close relationship, but also want to achieve a measure of independence and autonomy. And that's particularly true in Western cultures. Tends to work a little bit differently in some other non-Western cultures. The last indicator is impulsivity, and which is the capacity to control your own impulses, not to act without thinking, to engage in self-restraint when it's appropriate. That's a very important task of childhood. Any of you who have preschool children or have hung around a preschool have seen lots of instances of kids acting out impulsively. It's pretty normative during that age period and younger. And in fact, one of the tasks of preschool or the preschool period is to try to get kids to exercise some self-restraint and not just lash out and hit someone when they're angry or yell at someone when they're mad at them. Well, this task may also, or failure to master this task, may also result in risk for the development of borderline pathology. And the last indicator is the lack of coherent sense of self. Now, this difficulty may arise from a failure in identity formation processes and self-understanding in childhood. Again, another important developmental task. Now, the recognition of the self as independent of others begins very early in infancy, and understanding of the self continues to grow more sophisticated with age when development proceeds adaptively. When it doesn't proceed adaptively and there's problems with the development of the self, this may be an indicator of risk for the development of BPD. Now, we hope that study of these five indicators of risk for the development of BPD will help and increase research in this area, such that researchers looking at samples of children and adolescents can study these indicators, follow those children longitudinally over time to determine how well these indicators do tell us important information about the development of borderline pathology. And I'm going to tell you about a research study in a moment in which we did that in my research lab. But first of all, I want to go on to the second approach that we identified that looked at the question of how developmental processes might be involved in borderline pathology. And this is a perspective put forward by Caspi and Shiner, in which they propose that risk factors for adult borderline may reflect atypical patterns of normal personality development in childhood. And they identified five different ways that they thought personality development may result in psychopathology. And I want to briefly touch on those. The first is what they call the vulnerability association. And this is when personality and temperament may create vulnerability to risk factors for borderline personality development. For example, research evidence shows that children with difficult, hard-to-soothe temperaments are at heightened risk for abuse by caregivers, which in turn may increase the likelihood of the child developing BPD, because we know that abuse is an important risk factor for the development of of the disorder. The second way that Caspi and Shiner propose that personality development may result in psychopathology, they call the spectrum association. And by this, they mean that borderline personality disorder, or really any of the PDs, may reflect the extreme end of normative personality dimensions. So the person is simply exhibiting a lot of whatever personality characteristics may be relevant. And they cite one particular study that Mary was involved in, where scores on the five-factor model of personality actually predicted as much or more variance in BPD than a measure that was actually designed specifically to assess borderline pathology. Resilience Association, they propose that there may be some personality traits that actually have the opposite effect, that they buffer the child or the youth from developing borderline personality disorder, even under adverse conditions that where we might normally expect that the youth would be at risk for the development of the disorder. For example, having personality characteristics such as an easygoing or affectionate personality appears to buffer at-risk children from developing borderline. So personality may have an enhanced risk, and it also may diminish risk, depending on what the personality characteristics are and how they're expressed. Maintenance association. Personality profiles may make individuals more or less responsive to treatment of borderline personality disorder. Certainly, you think about the pool or the pie of individuals who suffer from BPD, that's not a homogenous group. There's a lot of variation within those groups, and there may be some characteristics that certain individuals in that group have that make treatment more or less effective for them. For example, individuals who suffer from BPD who are high in conscientiousness may be more likely to do what they're supposed to do according to their therapist and their treatment plan, which may then in turn make that treatment more effective for them and lead to greater improvement over time. The last proposal that Caspi and Shiner talk about, they call the scarring association, in which they propose that the experience of borderline personality disorder may actually alter personality development itself. There's been little research that's been done in this area, but they argue that this particular association may be especially important in childhood because that's the time when personality itself is forming, and so it's the time when other factors can have the most impact on the development of disorder and on the development of personality itself. And they give an example that simply being given the diagnosis of BPD may affect the individual's tendency to evaluate themselves in a negative fashion. It may lead to negative evaluation by others, which then makes them think about themselves in a different way. And so that experience itself may then alter personality development. And I think this particular point is a good one when we're talking about the term borderline personality disorder, and some have mentioned wanting to change that. I personally hate that term, and myself have spent many hours, often in the shower. I don't know why, but often my creative thinking happens in the shower. And trying to come up with a better name. I too haven't come up with a better name, but I wish to heck someone would do it. Maybe we need to have a contest or something. I certainly would put up some of the prizes because I don't like the label. But if it is true that simply being given the label can alter personality development in a non-adaptive way, that's a problem when we're talking about studying children and adolescents. Okay, the third approach to the question, how might developmental processes be reflected in borderline pathology, is that borderline pathology exists in childhood, but it's expressed in age-appropriate ways. So this approach is based on the idea that children may exhibit features of borderline pathology before reaching adulthood, and that rather than looking for risk factors, as in the prior model, researchers would assess rudimentary forms of borderline features among children. Now, this perspective doesn't necessarily posit that the full-blown disorder exists in childhood. I know not everyone would agree with me about that, and I go back and forth on that one myself. It instead takes the approach that because personality is still forming during childhood, borderline pathology may be less stable than in adulthood, and children may transition out of such a trajectory, particularly if they are exposed to effective prevention or intervention approaches. And so this approach instead assumes that childhood borderline features may place children on a developmental trajectory toward adult BPD, much in the same way that conduct disorder in childhood is predictive often of antisocial personality disorder in adulthood. So there may be some other, whether we want to call it a disorder or I don't know what we want to call it, but there may be some other set of problems or issues that are developmentally appropriate for children and that serve as precursors to a full-blown disorder later in adulthood. So in order to test this particular premise, we constructed what we hope is a developmentally appropriate measure of borderline features for children that was based on the Personality Assessment Inventory, or the PAI, developed by Leslie Morey. And Dr. Morey actually gave us a great deal of help in developing this particular measure. And Maureen, yeah. You probably helped with this too, didn't you?
Yeah.
So I thought, that's Maureen Ulby back there, who was one of my first students at the University of Illinois, has her own private practice in social work here in the Twin Cities, and she was working in my lab and helped us to adapt this measure. This is a self-report instrument with 24 items. I'm talking now about the PAI that we used as the basis for the measure that we developed. The PAI at the time was appropriate for individuals ages 18 and older. In recent years, that has changed and Les has downsized it for use with adolescents as well. But at the time, it was appropriate for individuals age 18 or older. It consists of a number of subscales, and one of which assesses borderline personality features. And this measure has been particularly useful for the assessment of non-clinical populations, which is why we chose it, because I wanted to look at a relatively benign community sample of kids at just a typical school. So this wasn't done the opposite, in fact. The PAI BOR measure assesses four domains: affective instability, identity problems, negative relationships, and self-harm. And what we did was we adapted the items of the adult measure so that they addressed the same underlying constructs but in an age-appropriate manner. So they were consistent with the developmental capabilities and what was going on with the children. And we developed it so that it could be used with children as young as 9 years of age. So we created the Borderline Personality Feature Scale for children, the BPFS-C. I love those little things. They're very confusing. We kept the same subscales as the original BOR, and here's some examples of the items. For the affective instability subscale, an item is, my feelings are very strong. For instance, when I get mad, I get really, really mad. When I get happy, I get really, really happy. Identity problems, I feel that there is something important missing about me, but I don't know what it is. This is the subscale that's the hardest for young kids to really understand. The others are a little bit more readily understandable to them. Negative relationships, I've picked friends who've treated me badly. And self-harm, I get into trouble because I do things without thinking. The self-harm scale, because we weren't using a clinical population and we're going into regular schools, we don't include items that are involve self-injurious behavior. Now, kids respond to each of these items on just a 5-point Likert scale, from not at all true about me to always true about me. And we use this measure in a study of 400 kids in grade school, 4th, 5th, and 6th graders. So they're approximately 10, 11, 12 years of age. And as you can tell, you can see here, it was a fairly diverse sample with in terms of ethnicity and race. So we recruited kids from local elementary schools. It was conducted here in the Twin Cities area. And we used a prospective design. It was a short-term longitudinal study. We went in at time one. It was the fall of year one. We went back at the end of the school year, so about 6 months later. And then we went back the following year, the fall of, actually that should say fall of year two. Time three is the fall of year two. That's a typo. And what did we do? Well, we administered the measure that we had created, the borderline personality features measure. We also assessed depressive symptoms using the Children's Depression Inventory, a self-report measure. And we also tried to assess independently the childhood risk factors for borderline pathology that I mentioned first of all in that very first model. Now, in this study, we only had 4 of the 5 indicators, and the ones that we included were hostile, paranoid worldview, and intense, unstable, inappropriate emotion, overly close relationships, which we indexed as exclusivity with a best friend, wanting your friend to be exclusively your friend, and getting very jealous and angry if your friend wants to develop relationships with anyone else. Impulsivity, which we indexed as relational and physical aggression. Relational aggression, for those of you who may not know, involves harming others by manipulating relationships, as opposed to physical aggression, which harms others using physical damage or the threat of physical damage. And we conducted some linear mixed model analyses to see how over time the risk factors that we identified, those 4 risk factors, tracked with increases in scores for a borderline personality measure. And we found that each of the 4 risk factors tracked. In other words, as for individuals for whom the borderline personality features scores increased, their scores for each of the risk factors also increased over time. So they were changing together. So if the risk factors went up, so did scores on the borderline personality measure. And they all tracked uniquely with borderline personality features, except for one aspect of impulsivity, which was physical aggression. We found that when we put relational aggression in the model, physical aggression drops out. We found that with other samples as well, including samples in adulthood. We also looked to see how stable the scores were for the borderline measure over time. And as you can see here, they were relatively stable with correlations that ranged from 0.47 to almost 0.6. So this is maximum about a year's period of time. It's not a long period of time, but it's about 12 months. We also looked at gender differences, and in our sample, girls reported significantly higher levels of borderline personality features than did the boys. We also wondered if our measure that we thought was uniquely identifying or assessing borderline personality features, maybe we've created was a general measure of problems and psychopathology in general. So we included the Children's Depression Inventory as a way, as an initial way of testing this hypothesis. Certainly there's more work that needs to be done. So we controlled for depressive symptoms because we know that depression is often comorbid with borderline pathology. And we found that it didn't make any difference, that even controlling for depression We still got the same association between borderline pathology and the risk factors and our measure scores on the measure of borderline personality. So, conclusions. I think that developmentally appropriate childhood risk approaches to the study of borderline pathology, as well as the development of measures that are age appropriate, hold promise for increasing our understanding of borderline personality features and disorder in adulthood. However, we have a lot more to learn. The number of questions remains considerably larger than the number of answers at this early stage in our collective research efforts. But again, I'm encouraged by the number of people who are presenting here on the development of borderline pathology, as well as the response that we've gotten to the special issue that I mentioned earlier. I know there are a lot more investigators out there looking at these issues, and now collectively what on our agenda, I think one of the first items needs to be convincing the federal government that these types of studies are worthy of financial support. Thank you. Thank you. Good question. Just for a child, how do you distinguish between BPD and antisocial personality disorder? That's a really good question, and I think I tend to a couple of things. One is that I'm hoping that the distinction between relational and physical aggression is going to give us some way of distinguishing between BPD and APD, with physical aggression being more predictive or characteristic of APD and relational aggression more characteristic of BPD. I also think in the realm of relationships and overly close relationships that we're going to in children, there's a construct called uncallous, unemotional traits, which is similar to psychopathy in adults. And I think that that's probably more characteristic of kids on a trajectory for APD than those on a trajectory for BPD, for whom more exclusivity in their relationships when they're in childhood, as I mentioned earlier, wanting their friend to be just their friend. We find that in kids who are relationally aggressive, which I said earlier is related to borderline pathology in childhood, we find that kids who exhibit those kinds of behaviors develop friendships that are overly intimate. In fact, that's how I got interested in this topic to begin with. I mean, my background is really in the study of social development and the development of aggression in children. However, when we started looking at the friendships of relationally aggressive kids and comparing them to the friendships of physically aggressive kids, we discovered that those who were relationally aggressive had friendships that were more intimate than the average developing child. And we thought, what is up with this? Intimacy is supposed to be a really good thing, right? What is going on? I still remember the day that we sat in the lab and Maureen was there, and I said, oh my God, these guys look like baby borderlines. And then I realized I knew nothing about the topic, and we started doing literature searches and talking to people who were experts in the area. And that's how this work started to begin with. So I think that's looking in the relationship area, I think, is another way that might help us distinguish. I also think it is very interesting that we do have a childhood disorder, conduct disorder, that is predictive of APD, and we don't have anything similar for BPD in childhood. Great question. All right, let's see. If a child excels at athletics, may this disguise a personality disorder? I don't think so. I hope not. I'll have to check with my friends and colleagues in the Department of Kinesiology about that. But I would say no. I would say you could no. All right. Okay. thinking about these. I'm not rejecting them. They're tough questions. Okay. What about such predisposing factors as prenatal exposure to cocaine or maternal mental illness? Diagnosis? Yeah, absolutely. You know, I certainly haven't talked about that. It's not my area of expertise, but I'm working on a grant proposal, again, with Dante Cicchetti, proposing to look at the development of borderline personality features in childhood using a longitudinal perspective design. And we hadn't thought about prenatal exposure to cocaine, but we certainly would want to do a good developmental history and that kind of a study, and also look at parent psychopathology as well. And we did try to look at that in one of our longitudinal studies, specifically parents, both mothers and fathers. It wasn't just maternal mental illness. And we didn't find a whole lot with that particular sample, but I think it has to do with the intricacies of that particular sample. Those are good ideas, though. I think a great thing to look at. Okay. Oh, this asks, wants to know exactly how the Bohr scale was adapted for children. This involved a lot of very detailed conversations and bootstrapping, going back and forth. Primarily, initially, it was with Dr. Morey, who developed the PAI to begin with, because we would sit in our lab and we would come up with what we thought were age-appropriate adaptations of a particular item, and then we'd run it by him, and he'd say, no, 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 no. This particular word is going to pull for this, and that's not what you want. You need to change it to this. And so it was very time-intensive and arduous. And then it involved piloting it with children to find out what their interpretation was of the items and whether or not they were interpreting it in the way that we intended for the item to be interpreted. We kind of used them as child consultants. I started doing self-injurious behaviors at age 6. Is that common among children with borderline traits? Certainly, yes. I would say yes, it is. And there are a number of folks, it's again an area that has been understudied, but there are a number of folks out there who have been looking at self-injury and the development of that kind of behavior in childhood and adolescence, and yes, it is common among those with borderline features or traits. How can I obtain, this one's for maybe you, Perry, how can I obtain a list of references with complete or full citation for the studies referenced in each presentation today? Should they, will you put something on the website? Okay, great. Easy one, good. Okay. Is my borderline measure available for general use? Absolutely. Email me and we'd be happy to send it out to you. It's free. I don't charge for any of my measures. I think the more people that can use them, the merrier. And in fact, the measure is being used in a number of different labs, not only in this country, but in a number of other countries. And I'm very excited about that, because then I'll be able to talk about their findings as well once those studies get completed. And this person also asked how I assess the childhood risk factors in my study. Depressive symptoms, the Children's Depression Inventory is a widely used self-report measure developed by Maria Kovacs. It's used a lot in clinical settings as well as in research studies. Now, the risk factors they were really asking about. The antenna attributions and feelings of distress for ambiguous relational conflicts, that is a self-report measure that I developed and have used in a number of studies, and many other investigators have as well. The overly close relationships is a subscale. The exclusivity with the best friend is a subscale from a friendship qualities measure that a former graduate student, Jenny Grote-Peter, and I developed, so that's a self-report. Relational and physical aggression in this study, I believe we used teacher reports for that. Can't quite recall. We use a lot of different, it wouldn't have been self-reports, I can tell you that. It was either teacher reports or it was peer reports that we used. We do have a self-report measure, but we wouldn't have used it in this study because I don't find it to be as valid with kids this age as I do teacher or peer reports.
Vicki, I think that one was the peer report.
Was it the peer report? Thank you. Good to have someone who knows my work better than I do. This is good. Thank you, Maureen. Let's see. Hold on a second here. And I think this might be the second one we got on this. How do you distinguish between bipolar disorder and BPD in children and adolescents, especially as bipolar disorder diagnoses have been rising in children and adolescents? Yeah, they definitely have been. That's a darn fine question. I'm not really sure. Does anybody have any ideas out there in terms of diagnosis? How you would distinguish between bipolar and BPD, especially in childhood? Nobody else has ideas either. Okay, I'll keep thinking about that one. I'm not really sure. Yes. That's okay. That's fine. Yeah, that's a really great idea. To talk about mood reactivity being different for bipolar than for BPD. That's a great idea. Yes, she said that that mood in adults for bipolar, there are definite criteria for how long the manic episode, for example, would last, and that you could maybe be able to distinguish between a manic episode versus a borderline personality difficulty with emotion regulation. Right, right. Good. Other thoughts? Okay. Was there one other thought? Somebody else? No? Speak now or a yes? Tracking sleep patterns for adolescents. She said, particularly having the parents do that. And with the adolescent as well. That's another great idea. Thank you. Ideas as to why children fail to master impulse control. There are a lot of different ways. Obvious one that we often go to is socialization by parents, teachers, peers, and others. It's very common for kids when they're young to not be able to exhibit impulse control and have to be taught that. Certainly there's individual differences in that, though, that have to do with things like temperament. There's likely a genetic, a heritability role to some degree that interacts with the environment and socialization with, kids in some cases not learning that they need to have impulse control. That there are settings in which they can't have everything that they want, and maybe getting reinforced, perhaps in a coercive cycle like Jerry Patterson talks about, where kids get they get reinforced for acting out. They get what they want. If they throw a tantrum in Target because they want the candy bar, and mom or dad are embarrassed, or for whatever reason they just give in and give them the candy bar. What are they going to do the next time they go to Target? They're going to act out and be impulsive. So, that certainly plays a role, but I think there are probably biological predispositions as well that play a role with that. Can you give an example of normal impulsive behavior in adolescents versus an impulsive behavior in adolescents that is more indicative as a precursor to BPD? Yeah, good question. That's a million-dollar question, isn't it? That's a real hard one to distinguish, both as a parent, a researcher, a therapist. Let me see. Normal impulsive behavior in adolescence I would think about things like, you know, perhaps experimenting with illegal substances, maybe smoking, maybe pot, maybe, you know, things that are not illegal if you're an adult, but they are if you're underage, I would think would be a good example of a pretty normal impulsive behavior in adolescence. Now, you know, even the problem with normal impulsive behavior in adolescence is sometimes it can get you into trouble in ways that then follows you throughout adulthood, and so it isn't quite so normal anymore because of its ramifications, but it is pretty common for kids to try on adult kinds of behaviors during adolescence, as opposed to impulsive behaviors that are more indicative of a precursor to BPD or even to APD or other kinds of personality disorders. And I would think of those behaviors as being much more extreme, you know, self-injurious behavior, for example. Although, unfortunately, self-injurious behavior is, I've read recently on research showing that there tends to be, they're now showing there can be a contagion effect for that, much like we found for bulimia. You're finding that too. Yeah. So even that area is going to be difficult to figure out what is normal and what is more on the maladaptive end. Could it be your lack of being funded by NIMH reflects a conscious or unconscious hostile countertransference towards this difficult, I thought they were going to say towards me, I was worried there for a minute. That could be, I don't know, towards this difficult pull of BPD patients by a profession. No, I don't think that's true. And the reason I don't think that is because they do provide quite a bit of funding for studies of BPD in adulthood. What they specifically have been resistant to are studies of the etiology or the developmental precursors of borderline pathology. In fact, there have been, in the last 10 years, there have been a number of RFAs, requests for applications, where NIH specifically puts out a call for, we're interested in blah. If you're interested in that too, apply and maybe we'll fund you. There have been a number of those specifically targeting borderline personality disorder, but they don't, they're interested more in adulthood or in, if you look at individuals prior to adulthood, they want you to use the DSM to diagnose borderline personality disorder. They aren't open to looking at more in community samples. They want you to be looking specifically at the kids at the end of the spectrum who are very disordered, which is very important as well, but we need to have both of those approaches, looking at the high end of the spectrum as well as normally how these things happen in more normally developing populations in order to understand the development of these things over time. Oh, good grief. Some of these, please don't feel bad if I'm not answering your question. Some of these are probably much more appropriate for a person who does clinical practice on a day-to-day basis, which I do not do. I mean, that's what my degree is in clinical psychology, but I'm really a researcher who does research that I'm hopeful others will translate, and I can help with that. Okay. This one I'm not the best to answer, but I want to raise it and see if others have ideas about it, because I think it's really important. It says, parents of BPD across the U.S. and the world are often confronted with professionals who have very limited knowledge or willingness to diagnose BPD. What is being done to educate the general mental health community? And see, parents' biggest problem is to find a professional both able and willing to diagnose BPD. Well, Perry, your organization does a great deal of that kind of work, right? Is there anything that you'd want to add? to a parent? Okay, okay, I think that's a very important question. I think the fact that this is, what, the seventh conference of this type, did you say, Perry, and is a really good indicator of the increased attempts by relevant parties and organizations to get the word out. Not that more can't be done, it certainly can, but I think we're going in the right direction. So has there been research into the impact of adoption during infancy or later in childhood in BPD? That's a really good idea. I don't know of any research on that. There certainly is a great deal of research that exists on the impact of adoption on other kinds of development and adjustment, but I don't know of any studies. Does anyone in the room know of one? Yeah. As I said, there's been very little research in general done on this problem in childhood. Okay. I think I'm going to hand the rest of these over to other presenters who might be better able to address them than I can, but I want to thank you for your attention. And